It's one of the things I've admired about Mike Schilt is his willingness to be human and his willingness to lead, you know, in a very human and productive way. My observation of him is that he would be a great guy to play for, because you know where you stand. There's no mind games being played. He's direct. He's honest. He'll admit it when he makes a mistake. And you know, that's to me as a guy I'd want to play for, or be around on a daily basis.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and that is the voice of Tim Jamison, longtime Mizzou head baseball coach and now the pitching coach for the Salukis at Southern Illinois University, and a friend who once allowed a young wannabe baseball writer to pepper him with questions through 4 years of college, and about 25 years ago was kind enough to teach that punk undergrad scribe a lot about baseball. A lot. TJ led Mizzou to the Big 8 title in 1996, and at one point had 7 consecutive NCAA regional appearances with the Tigers. He also was part of a program that had draft picks like Ian Kinsler, Kyle Gibson, Aaron Crow, and of course, 3-time Cy Young Award winner, Max Scherzer. Jamison joined the BPIB before getting on a Zoom call with one of his pitchers to discuss various grips on a cutter. That's just one example of how tech has changed coaching and how coaching is done during this time of the coronavirus quarantine. That's just one topic in a conversation that spanned coaching culture, competing in college, and of course, stories about the development of Mizzou's Hall of Fame-bound Mighty Max Scherzer. TJ, Coach Jamison, all the different names I've called you through the years, thank you for joining me. Where do we find you now here?
As of today, I'm actually in Carbondale, Illinois. I had been in Columbia since this COVID stuff hit, and I needed to come over and take care of a few details, and actually going to head back to Columbia tomorrow.
What has this time been like for you?
Well, again, for me personally, it's been very disappointing because it took me better part of 3 years to get back into coaching, and then found a destination that I really love and a group of players that I really love being around. And it was taken from us, you know, and so selfishly it's been very disappointing. And I look forward to getting back to it. I told them, I said, I almost feel like I'm a senior. And that, you know, I don't know how many years I'm going to continue to coach or have left. So it hurt me a little bit more than maybe a freshman than it would.
What have you been able to do at a distance? I think that's the kind of the question at every level, amateur and professional, is how do you coach at a distance? How do you make sure that players continue? And yours is a little different because the season was canceled, whereas for like the professionals, they're still holding out this thought that they'll be able to play somewhere, somehow, in some fashion of baseball this year. But development still occurs, still has to occur without a game, right? So how do you do that at a distance?
It's difficult and it's frustrating because you don't have that daily contact in person. You know, we're limited on our ability to be with them and to instruct. But so it starts with continuing the relationship. And so you, like what I've been doing, I've been trying to talk to each pitcher individually every couple of weeks without having a destination, Derek. Like, so what are we shooting for now? Are we shooting for summer ball? Are we shooting for fall ball? Or so without having a destination, it's really difficult to even give them a throwing program. And then each guy, how much have they been doing what they've been asked to do or instructed to do, how many guys have access to someone to play catch with, lift weights, all that type of stuff. So essentially what I've told them is I've given them a throwing program that's kind of in the middle and just said, stay on it. It's just nothing else gives you something to do. But then when we have a destination, then we can work backwards with the calendar and figure out exactly what they need to do on a daily basis.
How has technology aided this? I mean, that has been in your time in coaching and in my time being around baseball, that obviously has been the quantum leap that the game has made, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years. But, you know, the programs and the coaches who are on the cutting edge of tech, you know, it's become more popularized. How has that been utilized? How can that help in this regard?
Well, I think it's difficult. Well, other than the ability to communicate has mm-hmm. been made easier, whether it be through a Zoom phone call or so you can actually see the body language and make eye contact.
Yeah.
But really, from a distance, it's very difficult to utilize the other technology that's out there. Other than so I'll send them video links. I'll send them things to read. I'll send them things that they can do on their own. But obviously, they don't have access to the technology other than what's in their on the internet or what's in their computer. So right now, it's you're a little bit affected by the distance of the relationship as much as anything.
Interesting. Yeah. Let me just pause quickly to tell everyone about our sponsor, Closets by Design of St. Louis. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. That's Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. The official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. I'm not sure. I remember when I first met you. I'm not sure you remember when you first met me, but it was 1993. I believe it was Labor Day weekend. And there were walk-on tryouts at Mizzou. You were the pitching coach then at the time. Gene McCarter was the coach and John Cohen was the hitting, or I'm sorry, it was the head coach and John Cohen was the hitting coach. I believe I have all that right. But it was the next spring that I got to cover the team and got to know you more. And then you became the head coach the next year after Gene McCarter retired. Was at Mizzou, had, seven consecutive regional appearances. I think it was your second year as head coach there at Mizzou that you go 20-8 in the Big Eight, and the last year of the Big Eight, if I remember correctly, and win the conference. And then go off to a regional that was star-studded with Lance Berkman and Mark Kotze. And that was also the regional where I got kicked out of the press box, a little press box by Kevin Costner, because his beloved Cal State Fullerton team was there. But I want to talk to you about like what college baseball was like then and what it's like now and how radically it's changed. Has the style of play changed? Has the style of development changed? Is it recognizable from, when I first started covering your teams and you and I talked a lot about baseball, is it galactically different?
I don't know, Derek, that the game is that much different. What's played between the lines. You've got certainly better developed players that starting at earlier ages. You've got better coaches who have learned how to learn more about the game, have learned more about how to coach. You've got baseball programs and conferences that have on kind of both ends of the spectrum. Majority of them have invested in college baseball, made it a better sport, made it a more fan-friendly sport, more exposure nationally. And then there's others that have, obviously dropped their programs and for financial reasons. But I think for the sport has grown in terms of the exposure with the access. I mean, back then you're talking about no internet, no cell phones,
no.
Yeah, very little TV coverage. You're very fortunate if you're on television at any point in time. And so the game has a tremendous amount of exposure now, and it's been great. And I think of course, you referenced the technology and the ability to use the technology to help in the development of players. But I think it's also the player's ability to get on the internet, which is both good and bad, and find ways to develop even before they join the college ranks. And then you've got, when I first tripped at Team USA in 2005, the players didn't have advisors at that age. The college sophomores who were the best players in the country, Max Scherzer being one of them, he didn't have an agent at that time.
Wow.
And the influence of that into the game has changed the game quite a bit in terms of really the relationship between players and coaches and how the players develop. But I think the bottom line is the game is still the game. You have to have a coach-player relationship that is built on trust, built on the coach identifying that I'm here for you, and this is it's a collaborative effort to help make you as good as you can become, And through that, then the players will buy into what the coaches are selling, and they'll use that information to help in their development. And so I think a lot of things have changed, but the relationship between coach and player is still probably the most vital piece in terms of development.
How does that, I know how it starts. I mean, I would imagine it starts during the recruiting process, but how does that then sort of galvanize, does that have to galvanize early in a player's career with a coach early on in the first few years? Is that when it kind of takes hold?
It does start in the recruiting process. And so you're selling, obviously you're selling the university, you're selling the baseball program, you're selling the conference, but ultimately you're selling yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you're how you've treated people in the past, how you treat the players in the program. That's what a lot of the people want to know. It's not just the things that you can see, but it's more the things that they can feel and that they can touch. And so they want to know who you are as a person, and you can't BS them for very long. And once they arrive on campus, it's the continuation. I mean, you trust is something it's a daily process. It's not something that just happens, you know, once and then you got it. It's how you conduct yourself as a coach and how you treat the players. And it doesn't mean that you're always kind. It means that here's a certain standards and behaviors that we expect. And then you hold those people accountable to that, but there's a consistency and the players know that it's in their best interest.
You played college ball at UNO and had the benefit there of an earlier start to the season because of the weather, though not quite like Miami, but still an earlier start to the season. Then you take over at Mizzou, a classic Midwest team where there's snow on the field at times when you're trying to play early season games. As you become head coach, how did you approach looking at leveling the playing field with teams that had better weather, that could recruit differently because of the access they had to year-round baseball?
That took me a while to kind of hone in on what I believed in terms of the weather. I mean, it's a reality. It's an uncontrollable situation. I think good coaches focus on things that they can control, not on things that they can't control. And I think that so here's our environment. And let's try to make the best of the environment, whether it's related to the facility or whether it's related to the weather. And I think being in the Midwest has provided an opportunity to become more creative in how you develop players. I think it'd be created an opportunity convincing players to embrace the circumstances in terms of this is who we are. But you know what's not going to take away from our ability to win games. And for a long time, Derek, we would avoid the weather in the recruiting process, particularly kids out of the area, you know, kids in Missouri, you can't fool them, or Illinois or whatever. But although kids in Illinois thought the weather was better in Missouri. But we started to address it directly with them because the reality of it was if we have kids that couldn't handle playing in the climate that we practice and play in, then they weren't serving us and they weren't serving themselves. So I learned that from Ian Kinsler.
Really?
And Ian was from Tucson, Arizona, transferred from, you know, he played junior college ball, Central Arizona, then played at Arizona State the year before he transferred. And we had a really cold fall. We never really talked about the weather. He never asked about it. And as I watched him during the fall, you know, we started to worry about, well, gosh, how's this warm weather guy going to handle the cold weather? It didn't bother him at all. He played through it. He got better. You know, it didn't impact his game in a negative way. He didn't like it, but he never complained about it. It never impacted his preparation and his performance. And you know what? He had the – I mean, you've seen him as a major leaguer. He's got the mindset of someone that here's my circumstances and I'm going to make the best of the situation. And so we wanted to encourage those types of players to play baseball in Missouri. You know, the reality of it is that we're going to have days where you're not going to enjoy being outside. And you're going to have days that here's the situation. Like, can you handle that? Can you still perform at a high level? And so instead of ignoring it, we embraced it and said, you know what, this is, we got to make sure that the players know this is our reality.
That's quite a team, too. You had Ian Kinsler and Jace Tingler on the same team, both now obviously roles in the majors and recently Padres, or current Padres or recent Padre.
And Tony Vitello Matt Hobb. Matt's a pitching coach at Arkansas and done very well in his career. And all four of those guys played together. Max was 1 year away from that group of guys. And so it was the beginning of a really special time in our baseball program. And I give a lot of credit to Tony and to Ian and to Jace and their impact on that run that we had.
Yeah. What Ian Kinsler was drafted in 03. And then, of course, Max Scherzer was the, in the first round pick there in 2006 along. And then not too far after him was Nathan Culp, the lefty who was drafted as well. Where in the discussion of how you compete with the geography you're dealt, and also the conference that you're in, where did developing pitching become a priority? I mean, that became something that you could sell to recruits that come here and improve here, but also there was probably also a competitive edge too, right? If you developed pitching better, that might be the way you compete while other teams go after and get some of the boppers.
It is always important, but I think in terms of the impact on recruiting, it took time, but our reputation inside the game of baseball, particularly in the professional community, the scouting community, and even the higher levels, was our ability to take guys who were undrafted and turn them into draft, not just draft picks, but pretty high draft picks. I mean, Aaron Crow wasn't drafted out of high school and ended up being a first rounder. Also, our ability to take kids who were drafted and improve their draft stats. Now, part of it, Derek, was the philosophy. Big part of it was the environment that they walked into and the mindset. But a big part of it too was the daily competition and that they got in practice and the competition that they got in the Big 12 and then SEC conference. And so there were a lot of factors, but the reality of it was we had the ability with what we were doing to take a guy from point A to point B, and I think it improved their ability to help us win, but also improve their ability to move on to the next level.
Can you describe Max Scherzer's trajectory in that regard? I remember visiting him on campus as he was an All-American and your ace, your Friday night guy. And he described to me arriving, he had been drafted by the Cardinals out of high school just in the area, but had arrived at Mizzou not with the fastball that he would leave Mizzou with, not with the mechanics that he would leave Mizzou with, and in fact, kind of just a jumble. He had told me that at one point in time, his mechanics were such that he always knocked his hat off because his arm would come across his brim, and he was just kind of searching. Violent. Yeah, yeah. Can you kind of describe his trajectory and maybe how he is an example of what you're describing there with pitching development?
I think Max is a good example in some cases, but Max, if you look at Max today, he was the same guy walking under our, physically, he was the same guy walking into our campus as a freshman. I don't know if he's gained a pound. He certainly hasn't gotten any taller. His body looks exactly the same. Still got the one blue eye, one brown eye that hasn't changed, but the thing about Max was Max had to be sold on our throwing program. Max had to be sold on the amount of throwing that was necessary to develop. He fought it for a while. He was a guy that didn't understand it at that age, the necessity of all the lifting and the running and the throwing and the days of throwing and throwing the day after you pitch. And so there was a little bit of resistance there. And then along with that, his mechanics were violent and needed to have to be tweaked a little bit and needed to slow down both physically and mentally. I think when it was freshman year, we spent a lot of time on just slowing his mechanics down, taking the foot off the accelerator a little bit. But when he made his biggest jump, Derek, was during the season of his sophomore year, when he finally realized that I have to back off the effort level in every one of my deliveries. and that I can still be very effective at about 95 to 97% of effort. And once he figured that out, his command got better, the stamina got better, the secondary pitches got better. And you're still seeing it today in this big league game where he'll pitch somewhere between 93 and 95 miles an hour. And then when he needs to, he'll go to 96 to 98. And he recognizes the moments where I need to step on the accelerator. But for the vast majority of the time, I need to take my foot off of it a little bit. And that was more of a, that was a mental adjustment for him. And, you know, he's such an intense competitor.
Yeah.
That he eventually had to learn how to back off of that a little bit. And what has been one of his greatest assets, at least as a freshman and maybe the beginning of his sophomore year, was more of a detriment.
You have to find, and I've talked a lot with young pitchers actually in the last week or so, just this notion of channeling their competitiveness and, you know, how to improve and know how to do that without games to pitch in. There's no pitcher hitter confrontation going on. There's no, there's no innings for them to get right now. So is there a way for them to either channel that competitiveness or learn how to hone it? And it seems like that is an element of what you're describing with Max. And also I think of like Crow and some of these other guys too, that, they have competitiveness that they arrive on campus with, but sort of harnessing right that and knowing how to use it, when to use it, becomes a part of their success, not just their physical mechanics, almost their mental mechanics.
And I think too, going back to what I said earlier, is at what point in time did Max trust us?
Oh yeah.
Well, and I think that, Max's freshman year, kind of an interesting sidelight with that. Right before Max's freshman year, the guy that recruited Max was a guy named Sean McCann, who was our pitching coach in 2003. Tony Vitello was our volunteer assistant coach with just kind of multitude of responsibilities. And Tony was an infielder at Missouri, had never pitched, was, you know, obviously a student of the game. So it didn't take him long to learn, but after we recruited Max in the 2003 season, Sean left and I needed to hire another pitching coach. And so I had choices to make between Tony and more experienced guys. And knowing who Tony was and my philosophy has always been to try and stay within the program. But so I hired Tony. But with the caveat of your first year, I'm going to coach the pitchers. And then as I become more comfortable with you doing it, I'll turn more and more of that over to you. And so Max's first year was kind of a combination of me and Tony. And then during the first year, it became Tony. And so I think the trust factor was he needed to trust both of us because we were both working. But then he had to trust our strength coach. And one of Max's biggest allies today is the strength coach who was there. The other name is Scott Bird, who was the strength coach at Missouri at that time. And so once we developed his trust, it certainly improved the speed in which he began to develop.
What was it like for you watching that World Series, especially the 48 hours or 72 hours where it's Max is supposed to start and then he has a press conference that he explains why he cannot start, which I sat in, and anybody who knows Max knows what kind of pain he had to have been in to make that call. And then he returns and pitches the game seven that ultimately ends in a championship. What was that stretch of time like for you?
It was special. It really was. It was, first of all, like you mentioned about Max, here's the same guy that pitched with a broken nose earlier in the season.
Yeah.
As you know, the innings speak for themselves. Over the course of his career, and so I was torn. I felt so bad for him. I was just hopeful not only that he could pitch, whether it be in Game Six or Game Seven, but that he could be effective. You know, the last thing you want to do is go out there and you're the reason why your team didn't win the World Series. You know, and so I was really hopeful that he would be able to taste that experience. I thought about Ian Kinsler when he was traded to the Red Sox during the middle of the year, and then they end up winning a World Series.
Yeah.
But he also got benched. I don't know if you remember, or not benched, but he was kind of – he did get benched. He didn't play as much. he made that what people thought was a huge error, what ended up being not a, you know, non-factor, but was being just compared with Bill Buckner.
Right. And great point.
I began to wonder, it's like, so will, when they won, did Ian really enjoy that victory? And did he feel like he was a big contributor in that? And yes, the answer to that question is yes, he did. And so I wanted Max to be able to not just win the World Series, but to feel like he had a direct contribution in the actual World Series. You know, he had, obviously had a contribution in getting there, but to be that guy that helped them get over the bump, and he did. And that, so it was a part of me was fearful that he wouldn't have that opportunity to experience that, but and I was hopeful that he would. And then obviously for side story to that too is Tony was at the World Series. Mm-hmm. A lot of Max's best friends are still teammates from Missouri. They were all there, and he shared that with them. And that's one of the great things about Max is he still has stayed very connected to the University of Missouri and the team, the guys he played with, and the coaches. And as big a moment as that was, he still made a point of making sure that he shared that with those guys
on the field there, TJ. When they set up the podium to hand out the World Series trophies and everything, the Max was with some of his friends and family, and then they're trying to get him up on the stage, and he's in tears. And my line of sight was behind Max as he goes up to the podium to join his teammates, and the World Series trophy is there. And right over his shoulder was his father. And I wish that I were skilled enough to get that photo. But I'll never forget like that image of a father seeing his son ascend to the moment that he'd been chasing. It was a really moving kind of image as the expression on his father's face as Max took the stage and then was shortly thereafter handed the trophy.
It just goes to show you the value of that relationship, but also the value of a team accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And, here's a guy that's won 3 Cy Youngs and no hitters and 20 strikeout game and, a ton of individual accolades. But, the impact that moment had on him because it was a team accomplishment. And certainly individual contributions to that team accomplishment, but it means so much more to be able to share those experiences with your teammates, but also again with your family and friends.
Watching that game, something that we probably don't ask enough about as far as media, but it becomes a really defining and important thing for professional pitchers is how they find a way to pitch when they're not at their best and the team needs the most from them. How do you talk to young pitchers about getting through games or providing innings when they don't have their best stuff, but still having success?
At that age, when they're in college, they haven't experienced a lot of those days yet physically. Mm-hmm. Those days are ahead of them, and they become more frequent. And so that they have to learn how to take the ball when they don't have their best stuff, or they don't have the, I remember a conversation with Kyle Gibson that I had because Kyle, he's been a tremendous asset to the baseball program, kind of along the lines that we've had so many guys that have done it. But there was a day before he pitched, and he just didn't feel right. It didn't feel good and was worried about his velocity. And so here's the common response of most young pitchers. They try to create the velocity with more effort. Well, I don't feel good, so I'm going to even try to throw harder, or I'm going to try and create this movement with more effort. And the reality of it is, it actually works in reverse, and they end up losing command and movement and deception and all the stuff that's really important and velocity too. And so, what they have to learn, and you can kind of help guide them, but they have to experience it themselves. So you don't feel your best. So let's actually back off a little bit today. Let's make sure we focus on the sequence of pitches, the movement, the command, all those things that are really important. And And that can be your focus changes from effort and velocity to command and movement and pitch. You may have to pitch backwards on that particular day. And so that they have to learn how to get people out in different ways. And so it actually becomes an asset for them. And that's the way you have to approach it.
That goes back to that trust element you were talking about too, because
and I think too, though, even and you're a dad, you know what I'm talking about with the kids is sometimes they just have to find out on their own.
Yeah.
And you can help prepare them ahead of time. But then once they do have more open ears and they have the ability to trust, they learn that. But more often than not, I mean, so Max has learned how to do that, but it wasn't anything necessarily that he learned at Missouri. It's just the accumulation of innings, but at least he had the mindset and a willingness to learn. And sometimes guys, the ones you battle the most are the ones that don't want to learn or afraid to learn, or afraid to be in a difficult or uncomfortable situation.
The phrase that they use around the Cardinals that applies is like a growth mindset, sort of an open idea that today you try to learn something that helps you tomorrow. Does that go to creating a culture in a college program as well? Is it fit there?
I think so. I think here's a mistake that a lot of coaches make, and not just young coaches, but the majority of them, because they haven't learned. But a lot of times what is not said is more important than what is said. And an example that I can give you with that is when I believe that coaching, like the best coaches, let the game teach the players how to play. And whether that's done through practice organization, drill development, how you create a drill. But there's a lot of young coaches that feel like they need to constantly tell the players what and how to do it. And the reality of it is that's not how development works, is that you have to give the players enough experiences in the situations or at the plate or on the mound or defensively, that they learn themselves. They learn how to feel it. They learn how to do it. And so I think the one of the downsides of all this data, Derek, and all this technology is you still have to filter the information that they should receive. And because they can only handle so much. And I mean, as a coach can only handle so. I mean, I'm blown away by trying to figure out what's important and what's not. And so I think the greatest coaches are the ones that temper the information and make it more individualized. But I think more than anything else is, okay, so here's a drill we're going to do today, and I'm not going to say anything. You're just going to do it, and then we can have a conversation after you do it. And so I think that the young coaches today feel like they have to constantly tell them what to do and how to do it.
The buzzword du jour is somewhat process, but like, as you looked into coaches who were successful and in other sports and in baseball, you found a lot of that though, where it wasn't exactly results oriented, like how you did wasn't based on the final score, that final score was the result of all the work you put in beforehand, what we would now call the process, or what players throw around as the process, right?
Right. Yeah, I think too with how you define wins. Is it effort based? Is it focus based? Is it attitude based? Is it trust? You know, all those different factors that ultimately will lead to a player or a team becoming the best that they could possibly become. And so I think it's important when you address a team. So here are a set of behaviors that are going to help you and going to help us become the best that we can become. And so, you know, regardless of what's on the scoreboard, you still need to focus on those things that have helped you in your development, again, individually and collectively. And so your language is very important in terms of the things that you talk about and the things that you address. And so the process that you're describing is essentially an accumulation of all the things that have been done and the behaviors that are appropriate that allow successful people to become successful. And so that's where the coaches mindset and the coach's direction should be in terms of how you communicate with the team and how you communicate with each individual player.
Do you think great coaches that are defined publicly by championships are actually defined by their peers or privately by their development of players?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. And you know, Derek, you know that I've been trying to write a book on coaching and trying to find – I was inspired by trying to find the similarities between successful coaches over a long stretch of time and in a multitude of sports, and both men's and women's. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to find out what did John Wooden and Vince Lombardi and Bill Belichick and Nick Saban and Mike Krzyzewski and, you know, go Gino Auriemma, and you go down a list of what did all of these people have in common in terms of how they developed, not just the player, but the person. And there are common factors, but a lot of it comes down to essentially relationships that, and the importance of relationships that they develop with these people. And then you know, one of the things that you mentioned was their impact, these coaches' impact on the culture of their programs. Yeah. And how they make decisions, both from a personnel standpoint and how they develop and all these types of things. But there are so many commonalities that all those people share, but they're human characteristics. It's not necessarily intelligence or you know, obviously the personality, because you're talking about, I mean, Vince Lombardi and John Wooden, and what a contrast in personalities, but the core of who they were very similar.
Can you give some examples of those overlaps? You know, like Gino Auriemma's competitive zeal seems to stand out.
It came down to, and I'm probably going to forget some of them, Derek, but I'll say seven or eight different things. But first of all, it's self-awareness in terms of who I am, what's important to me, my personal set of values. And so I have to have the awareness before I can then take that and coach somebody else. And so I think they all have that. You know, they all know who they are. They all know what's important to them. Even John Wooden had a list of values that he carried with him every day, and to help remind him and keep him on the direction he wanted to go. The second thing was that there was an intentional effort to create a culture that is driven by who you hire, having to fire, who you recruit, if it's or who you draft. And so, you know, the really successful coaches and programs are very intentional about the people that are attracted to them and they are attracted to. And so they help drive the culture by helping to drive the people that are in the clubhouse or in the dugout or on the sidelines or whatever it happens to be. But it's also who they hired it to instruct and coach those players or the same thing from the ownership on down. One is they're very intentional about building relationships and not just, you know, what they are as an athlete, but who they are as a person. And so getting to know them on a very personal basis, they learn how to coach them better. They learn how to approach them. And again, we're talking about the development of trust and all those things that are really important. So there's a buy-in from the players. And so they all value these relationships. And one of their values or one of their commonalities is continuing to learn. And we kind of already touched that. You mentioned growth mindset. But it's not just the need to learn. It's like they have to learn. They want to know more about the game. They want to know more about the how to teach the game better, and the technology and the things that are out there. There's a neat story about John Wooden, how he used to send out a questionnaire at the end of a year. There's a part of the game that he wanted to improve. So he would send a questionnaire out to a variety of coaches asking them, so what do you guys do? You know, what do you, or I, hey, I've noticed that you do this part of the game very, very well. How do you teach it?
Yeah.
And he did that till the day he retired. And I think he probably did that till the day he died. So there's a commonality with the wanting to continue to learn. There's a commonality of collaboration. And in terms of working with the assistant coaches, if you're the head coach, or working with the players and understanding that you know, we can all do this better if we all work together. And but then it kind of gets back to that culture piece. Well, if you're not willing to do that, then I, as even though you're a tremendously intelligent person, then I have to get rid of you. You know, I have to have the guts to get rid of you because you're not doing things the way that they're best for the culture. And that kind of leads to me what's probably the most important one, Eric, and what one that's lacking today is, and that's courage. And it's courage to support the culture with really tough decisions. It's courage to discipline the players with the intent of making them better. It's the courage to not doubt yourself when you're being attacked in so many different ways, you know, whether it be media, social media, you know, people have so much access to you now, but the ability to stand behind your beliefs, you know, even though sometimes they're attacked. And but the courage to me is what kind of separates good coaches from great coaches. And knowing that, you know, here's what works and here's what we believe in and here's who I am as a person. And here's how I'm going to treat you as a person, and being able to have the courage to stand behind that, and courage to make a lot of times really tough decisions.
There are a few things that through the years of covering sports that I've kind of seen that set baseball apart from the other ones. One is the obvious one is that it is largely defined by failure, especially when you talk about an offensive player. That's just the nature of the game is, the hitter's going to fail more often than he or she succeeds. And then the other one, which is a little bit more subtle, is that it's a daily game. It's just a daily grind. And maybe that sort of fits like two jigsaw puzzle pieces together with the failure aspect, because if you fail today, it's going to be there tomorrow, or a workout is going to be there tomorrow, or some way to get yourself distance between the failure is there tomorrow. And then the other part, and this strikes at what you were describing with the coaches, and the other part that sets baseball apart is it's a team sport that is made up of individual duels. And it's how somebody does as an individual within a larger team concept. How did I get any of those wrong? And also then how does adjusting some of these characteristics of great coaching, how do they have to kind of move to fit the specific nature of baseball?
Well, I think too is when you're around that number of people for such a long period of time.
Yeah, the daily grind. Yeah,
daily basis. It's unique, but it's not unique in terms of what works and what doesn't work. And I think I'm a big fan of Mike Schilt and watching him from afar. You probably got a better knowledge of what he does daily, but I truly believe that his players know that he's about them. It's not about him, and I don't mean like them making decisions and game strategy. I'm talking about the personal and the human side and the individual development. I think that goes a long way. Is that, you know, if I'm a coach or a manager, And I've treated you honestly. I've been upfront with you. I've had conversations with you. I care about you as a person. It makes it a lot easier to have those tough conversations when you have to have them, because it's a big part of it. You can't avoid them. You have to have whether a guy needs to sit on the bench or whether a role is going to change, who I'm starting in what positions, what the rotation looks like. Who's coming out of the pen, releasing guys, moving guys up and down. Those conversations have got to be had and handled the right way. But again, it starts with, is this guy coming at me from a line of bolt, or is he coming at me from a straight, the narrow? And I think that the successful teams obviously have a tremendous amount of talent. But there's that, again, that trust and that belief and that knowing, you know what, this is not what I wanted to hear, but I know you're telling me this from the bottom of your heart. And I think the best teams from top down are driven by really good people. And I think the people that are in the Cardinals clubhouse or another clubhouse is, and I'm sure you've seen it too, is there's really dark and moody and gloomy people.
Yeah.
In a clubhouse. And that gets really tough to deal with over the course of the season that you just described. Well, can you imagine having a multitude of people like that? And so I think the best teams, also the culture of the clubhouse, but also the reality of it is, you know, sometimes I got to get rid of, even though this guy's really talented, puts up really good numbers, I got to get rid of this guy because he's destroying our culture and our clubhouse. And those are really tough decisions. And I still think, though, that's the human part of the game. And I think the best teams and the best programs still understand that at a very high level.
Yeah, I'm always struck by the general manager who is aware of the player whose gravitational pull of sourness is affecting the play of another player, and the move that is made then to free up the player who is not naturally sour, who may be not have that in his personality, by moving the player who just is, you know, is influencing, sometimes a younger player, sometimes a peer, whatever. But I'm always struck by the general manager who has that feel for a clubhouse. And maybe it's the manager informing the general manager a lot of times. But I'm always struck by that. You brought up Shildt, and you offered me like a new way to look at him too, through that word courage, because here's a guy who did not play pro ball, walking into a major league clubhouse, not just didn't play major league ball, but didn't play pro ball. And he's managing these professionals, many of whom have been in the game for a while. There is an element of courage there, to me, that shows, I mean, we know he has courage of convictions. It doesn't take long to talk to him that you get that sense that he has a courage of convictions. But I think there's also an element of he has courage in his competence. And then the other part is he has courage to be wrong. And that, maybe that last part where he learns something new, or he admits a mistake, or the coaches say, hey, that's a fine idea, but why don't we do this? But then he puts his full force. He can say, oh yeah, I'm wrong. I'm thinking wrong. Let's go with your plan. And then puts his full effort behind that. That's something that he talks a lot about, is this idea that when they have meetings with coaches, that if somebody comes up with an idea that is different than yours and the group agrees that it's better, that once you walk out that door, it's your idea too. You don't go, oh, well, it wasn't my idea. No, you put your full effort behind even an idea that you may not have agreed with, but the group did. And I think that that's part of courage as well, is to accept when your view isn't taken or when your view was off.
I think not being concerned with who gets the credit.
Oh, great point. Yeah.
Incredibly valuable asset. And, you know, John Wooden, that's one of his best quotes, is that the team or the individual who's not concerned with getting the credit is the team that can become as good as they're capable of becoming. And I think the ego and insecurities and so many things that get in the way, but that's one of the things I've admired about him, is his willingness to be human and his willingness to lead, you know, in a very human and productive way. And I still think, and I believe this, Derek, is the way to get people to play their best and to be their best is to know that you're in a situation where you're not judging them based on their numbers or things like that, but you're judging them based on their effort and based on the things that they've done to prepare. And my observation of him is that he would be a great guy to play for, because you know where you stand. There's no mind games being played. He's direct. He's honest. He'll admit it when he makes a mistake. And that's to me as a guy I'd want to play for or be around on a daily basis.
Do you think this time without baseball, this stoppage, is a test of a team's culture, is a test of the leadership they get from their manager?
I don't think there's any question about it. I think in terms of, again, checking in with the guys on a regular basis, and again, not as a way to to hold them accountable to a certain level of exercise or workout or whatever. But I think more of us is, okay, so how are you doing? How's your family doing? You know, how can I help you? Talk to them about the disease, talk to them about what's going on, be as transparent as you can possibly be. But in that conversation, you're also going to find out or encourage them anyway to work out, share information with them. I think it's interesting to see what the Yankees have done with how they post, at least from a pitching standpoint, how they're posting what the guys are doing on a daily basis, and not as a way to call anybody out, but as a way to encourage guys to keep up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think all that stuff is really important, because if they get 3 weeks, they've had enough time off now, Derek, where basically what they did in Florida and Arizona doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
They're starting over. And so how much work they're doing now will allow them to expedite that, but there's still going to be a fear factor in, like, are guys really ready? You know, are we going to put guys at risk from a conditioning standpoint? And it sounds like they're going to have a condensed spring training if and when they come back. And that I think is going to create some anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. Which then goes back to the trust aspect that we talked about with pitching development and coaches. You know, the players are going to have to trust that the team has their best interest in heart and has a plan for them to be ready. Gosh, there's a lot to that. And I just, the more I've talked to people, Zach Thompson and a few other players that I've talked to, they call it the staying healthy, staying sane call. That's how they described it, that the team checks in to say, hey, are you staying healthy? Hey, are you staying sane? And I just thought that they're, you're right, there's a care aspect to that too, that is not like, hey, how many pitches are you throwing? It's more casual. It's more personal. It's more, how are you doing? Not what are you doing? And that's important. The more I think about it, the more I think that, like, some teams who know themselves and some teams who have the benefit of a strong chemistry in the clubhouse, strong leadership, a strong institutional culture, they're going to come out of this better than other teams who are listless or rudderless or don't have a good compass as part of their culture.
And I would bet, and I don't know this, there, but I would bet that Mike Schilt is encouraging Adam Wainwright and the other leaders of that team to have kind of group chats, mm-hmm. and stay connected and to utilize them to help spread the word and whatever that word happens to be. But it's not always coming from the manager or the coaches. It's coming from the players, but it's maybe instigated or not. It's initiated by the coach to his appropriate leaders and say, hey, listen, I need you to make sure that you guys are talking to each other on a consistent basis. And you know, you and I will check in. And so there's so many different ways to do it, but I think there's the ways to build leadership within your team and not having to be the guy in front all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I do know one thing he has been doing too. And he did this consistently coming out of the stoppage, was meeting with his coaches and making sure that the family aspect that they have going continues as well, so that he's not just delegating to his coaches, but that he's actually like taking time to chat with them, to keep up with them like friends would over this time. I thought that was really interesting. I want to talk to you about one last thing, and it actually is part of why I asked about the notion of developing a program, a college program, based on, you know, where you are geographically and trying to overcome some of the weather issues or recruiting issues or anything that comes with being, you know, either a northern team, northeast team, a Midwest team. It was brought up to me as scouts kind of try to figure out a way to do their job without being on the road for a draft that is inevitably going to happen. And their point was that there are teams that they did not see. There are teams that barely got their seasons off the ground because of the location of their school. How influential could that be in a draft? And how do you have a thought on how that might play out this year?
Again, this is my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about 5 or 10 rounds of players this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good decision. I hope it's 10, not 5. But these players that we're talking about in that area mm-hmm. have been being observed since they were 15, 16 years old.
Okay.
And many of them have played on really good select teams or played for Team USA or played, if they were college kids, played in really good, like Cape Cod League. So they've seen these guys numerous times. It's not that they needed to see them play another 10 games in March and April or May and make a decision. Now, you know, where, how high to pick them. I think certainly that comes into play, but they know these guys physically, Derek. That's the easiest part of the evaluation process is figuring out how good these guys are, and not just good, how good they are, but how good they can become. They know that by now. Okay. What they don't know necessarily is how signable. They may not know everything about the character. That kind of that soft side of the human development is the, you know, kind of a teammate, you know, what kind of a teammate they are. They may not have had the ability to do these psychological tests that a lot of these teams are doing now.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be in person to do that. That you're talking about conversations that can be had, and whether it be done again through Zoom or through just a phone call or talking to coaches and people that have surrounded these players over the years. But I think if once you get past the 10th round and, you know, you're starting maybe into the 20th round when you're starting to fill out rosters,
yeah,
you haven't necessarily really focused on those guys. I get it. I mean, I understand why these last 2 or 3 months of the season are important, but I just believe that the good scouts and the good organizations have done their homework by now, and they know who's on their draft board, and so it's just now it's a matter of again being a little uncomfortable because it's different.
And then the last question that's related to that is do you think college baseball might be different with the ability of these with a shorter draft and the ability of these players to return for 2021?
It'd be interesting to me to see. Well, first of all, I think it's because of the number of minor league teams that seems to be being contracted a little bit. So they're not going to have as many roster spots in professional baseball. So that should positively impact college baseball because you're going to have guys that honestly probably shouldn't sign and did sign that are going back to college or going to college in the first place. So again, we're talking about the cream of the crop right now that are going to get drafted. So there's going to be more good players and more old good players that go back to college baseball. And as our example, we had senior third baseman, a senior shortstop, a senior starting catcher, a senior first baseman, and our Friday night pitcher was a senior. And they're all coming back.
Oh,
they're going
great.
To make us better. You know, and I think it's a little bit different for the mid-major like SIU is compared to maybe an SEC school that relies mainly on sophomores and juniors, but the reality of it is you're going to have greater numbers of good players in the game, so it should make the game better.
That's great. A little deeper roster. Well, thank you, TJ, for joining me here. This has been great. On a personal note, I have to thank you for putting up with all of my questions way back at Mizzou, and teaching me a lot about the game. I felt more prepared going into covering baseball, whether it was covering college baseball later on or getting the chance that I always dreamed I might get of covering Major League Baseball. I felt more prepared because I went to Professor Jameson's baseball school there for a while.
Well, let me take the opportunity too, and you know this, I mean, you and I are still talking several years after those moments, but I follow you on Twitter and I read your article. Well, I mean, because of the positivity that you continue pronounce and your objectivity and who you are as a person. So I value our relationship more than you know.
No, I appreciate that. I can't properly articulate how much I got from just being around that Mizzou program as a reporter. And it at a time when everything is influential, right? You're just learning as a young adult. It reinforced a fondness for baseball. It augmented it. It probably, to be honest, made it exponential, my fondness for baseball, because I got to see how much care and thought you put into it. So Thank you very much, TJ.
Thank you, Derek.
A special thanks to Salukis pitching coach Tim Jamison for joining me on this episode of the Best Podcast in Baseball. I genuinely enjoy my chances to catch up with him, to talk to him about coaching, and of course to talk to him about baseball. You can find all of our ongoing baseball coverage, including a series of exclusive tales coming to the pages of the Post-Dispatch in the next week, at stltoday.com. If you're not a subscriber, there's been a series of deals available to people, so check at stltoday.com for any of the subscription deals that are currently going on. One that just ended was $5 for 5 months of coverage. Conversations about baseball's return for the 2020 season are starting to accelerate. There's been no date as of right now set for the resumption of play, but teams and players and agents are all wanting some guidance for how players should ramp up. There will be ongoing coverage of that at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. You can also find a whole host of podcasts at stltoday.com, including one on Mizzou, hosted by Dave Matter, and of course the hockey one. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design, any place you get your podcasts. Seriously, we've really expanded where the podcast is available. Of course, it's available on iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes. You can subscribe to the podcast there. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make the podcast possible. You can also rate and review the podcast there. I do check the ratings and reviews. In fact, it was some of the reviews and some of the emails that I got that I hope now we continue to improve the recording and the sound on this. I know that some people using some devices had difficulty with the volume, so hopefully I have corrected that. If not, I'm sure someone will let me know. A programming note, there will not be a Best Podcast in Baseball next week. That's the week that starts with Mother's Day. There will not be a new BPIB that week for reasons that I'm sure most everybody knows and many people can empathize with. I will be on furlough for that week and unable to produce a podcast. But stay tuned for the next week as we'll try to come back in full force and speed up towards whatever news is ahead as far as how baseball gets back off the ground when it's safe, when it's healthy, and when the CDC and cities and states say that it's permissible for baseball to come back. I know a lot of people are eager for its return, and just as many of us are eager and curious for how it returns. The Best Podcast in Baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. 1-800-BY-DESIGN. Closet by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the Best Podcast in Baseball. Again, thanks to Saluki pitching coach Tim Jamison for the Best Podcast in Baseball. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you in a couple weeks. Stay healthy.